This is Albert E. May. I was born in Chicago in 1909, the youngest of three children. In 1915, we moved to Milwaukee, where my father managed a men's department and a department store. I had a small Saturday evening post route at age 7 in Chicago, a larger one in Milwaukee from 12 on. Wisconsin had child labor laws, Illinois did not. I also clerked in a variety store on Saturdays at about 14, later in a department store, ushered in a movie theater, worked in the packing department at Gimbel's. I attended three elementary schools and two high schools, graduating from Washington High in Milwaukee in 1925. I spent my first college semester at Milwaukee Normal, which became Wisconsin State College in Milwaukee, and later UWM, because it was free. My next three semesters were at Joliet Junior College, the oldest junior college in the country. My family had moved to Joliet in early 1926. Neither Milwaukee Normal nor Joliet Junior College offered calculus, so when I entered Northwestern University as a junior, majoring in mathematics, I was probably the only junior math major in the United States who had not yet had elementary calculus. Needless to say, I had to do a lot of doubling up to complete the major requirements in the next 2 years. I took my Bachelor of Science in 1929, received a $500 fellowship, which entailed teaching one section of freshman algebra, and got my master's in 1930. During that year, Warren Weaver, head of the University of Wisconsin's math department, gave a lecture at Northwestern, and during his visit, offered me an instructorship at Madison starting the following year while I worked on my PhD. Northwestern had no PhD program in math at that time. So I came to Madison in 1930 and stayed with the University of Wisconsin until my retirement in 1974. I received my PhD in 1936, which was a slow time for getting positions. I had a choice of going to Michigan State or teaching in the University of Wisconsin's Extension Division, which was offering freshman and sophomore courses in various parts of the state. I liked the idea of being on my own, so I took the Extension Division opening in Racine and Kenosha. In the early days, the university classes in Racine and Kenosha were held at the local vocational schools. In 1946, Racine made the old McMinn Building available to the university to expand its offerings. Charles Wedemeyer was made director of this new Racine Extension Center, and I was named assistant director. I became director in 1954. In the early 60s, the title was changed to Dean. In 1967, the Racine Center became part of the new UW Parkside. In 1969, I asked to return to teaching at Parkside for my last 5 years before retirement. In the early 30s, the PhD program in mathematics required successful completion of certain required graduate courses, concentration in one area, passing a rigorous oral preliminary examination, passing a reading knowledge test in French and German, writing a thesis which added something new to known mathematical theory, and passing a relatively easy final oral examination. My major professor was Mark Ingram, who headed the department from 1932 until he became Dean of Letters and Science in about 1944. He helped me to choose an appropriate thesis topic and was readily available for consultation when I needed to try out ideas or get suggestions. Warren Weaver left in about 1932 to become a vice president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Dean Charles Slichter had little contact with the department. E.B. Skinner was close to retirement and gave no advanced courses. H.W. March was primarily an applied mathematician. The only other member of the tenured faculty was Rudolf Langer, a fine mathematician in the field which was then characterized as analysis. So almost all of my coursework was with Langer in analysis, or Ingram in the broad field characterized as algebra. In my last year at Madison, C.C. McDuffie came in as another good algebraist. We had seminars for the graduate students at which one of us might present a paper from some foreign journal. I remember, for example, giving something in matrix theory from an Italian journal. We had a mathematics club that heard and discussed presentations by department members or invited guests from other schools. We had no formal contacts with graduate students from other departments, although some from the physics department occasionally attended our math club meetings. All of us, I think, belonged to the Mathematical Association of America and the American Mathematical Society. Many of us attended the annual spring meeting of the American Mathematical Society at the University of Chicago each April, and other regional meetings which could easily be reached. Traditionally, a successful PhD candidate gave a 10-minute presentation of his thesis at the spring meeting in Chicago. As I recall, a full-time teaching load for an instructor in math was 4 courses, averaging 15 or 16 teaching hours a week. Most of us taught part-time. I went on full-time first after I married in early 1934. My income part-time in the spring term was about $80 a month. When I went on full-time in fall, I earned $1,500 a year, a princely salary. As instructors, we had no part in the running of the department. Glenn Frank was president of the university when I arrived in Madison. He was a polished speaker with a special love for alliteration. I remember hearing him speak at the university club at a time of trying budget problems with the legislature. Coming from New York, he said, I look forward to the less hectic environment of Madison. But after 6 months of tussling with the legislature, I found myself yearning for the sylvan solitude of the subway. I did not know Dykstra at all. E.B. Fred was a courtly gentleman and a fine president in my estimation. I will speak of Elvium and Harrington later. I lived at the University Club from 1930 until my marriage in 1934, rooming most of that time with Theodore Bennett, an assistant professor in the math department. I rarely ate at the club because meals for the week cost $10, and I could get a complete dinner from soup to dessert for 35 cents at Piper's cafeteria just off the square. The club dining room was a very popular place for faculty at lunchtime, and the reading room with many national popular newspapers and magazines was busy from 11 to 1 and again later in the afternoon. William Ellery Leonard, who lived nearby, still confined by railroad tracks to a small domain, appeared occasionally. Hayakawa, later senator from California, then a graduate student in English, met frequently with Miles Hanley of the English department, and a member of the German department for philological discussions. Mark Ingram was there almost every noon and played billiards for a short while after lunch. I attended football games, but no other athletic events, concerts, plays, and occasional lectures. I also became interested in duplicate bridge, played often on Saturday afternoons at the Madison Club. The director of the game was Cicely Weaver, stepmother of Warren Weaver. In 1935-36, I directed a new duplicate club which had just been formed. Two faculty members who became interested in duplicate bridge and played often at the Madison Club were E.B. Van Vleck, who had retired in the late 20s from a distinguished career in mathematics, and his physicist son, J.H. Van Vleck, who later went to Harvard and recently won the Nobel Prize in Physics. J.H. had an unusual talent which was used by many of the university departments. He had memorized and kept up to date the timetables of all railroads in the United States. So if some department wanted to bring a speaker from, say, Boulder, Colorado to Madison, they would just call Hasbrook and he would say, he gets a train out of Boulder at 8:16 a.m. on the Denver and Rio Grande, arriving in Denver at 10:36. At 12:10, he takes the Southern Pacific to Chicago, arriving the next afternoon at 1:15. Then he gets a Northwestern train to Madison at 2:45, arriving at 6:10 p.m. It was phenomenal. There were very few women on the faculty in 1930. The only one who comes to mind right now is Helen White in English, although I'm sure there were others. In mathematics, Florence Allen was a perennial instructor. She did a good job in teaching elementary courses. There were never more than two female graduate students in math while I was there, and no blacks at all. I was never conscious of prejudices, except for one minor incident in a low-level graduate math course. The instructor, whom I shall not name, was disturbed by seeing females on campus smoking in public. He commented that the first two women he had so seen were a Negro and a Jew, and then gulped when he realized that he had forgotten that I was Jewish. In the mid-30s, the university began offering certain freshman and sophomore courses in a number of communities around the state. These were administered by the University Extension Division. In Racine and Kenosha, we offered 2 years of English, 2 of mathematics, several history courses, some foreign language, physical geography, sociology, I think, and economics, I think. In Racine, these classes were housed at the Racine Vocational School. In Kenosha, in a portable, complete with an old-fashioned coal-burning stove, very much needed in Wisconsin in winters, which was part of the Kenosha Vocational School. Registration was done by an Extension Division field man. Ours was Mike Lowe, who lived in Milwaukee and who covered a prescribed area of the state. Almost all courses were taught in 2 meetings a week. The instructors were mostly graduate students based in Madison, appointed on the recommendation of the appropriate department in Madison. And they would have all their classes scheduled on a Monday and Wednesday or a Tuesday and Thursday. So they would need to be away from Madison just 3 days a week. Almost always, these were PhD candidates who were through with their own coursework. In 1936, I was the only resident instructor in our area, perhaps the only one in the state. I may also have been the only PhD in the system at that time. I taught algebra, elementary analysis, theory of finance, and calculus, usually two courses a semester in Kenosha and two in Racine. The student quality was on a par with corresponding Madison classes. Both Racine and Kenosha had good public school systems. The students had no extracurricular school activities. Many had part-time jobs. By the early 40s, enrollments had increased substantially, but with the advent of World War II, registrations plummeted. In 1942, I asked to go on half-time, moved my classes to the evening, and became an aircraft engine test inspector at Nash Motors in Kenosha. They were making Pratt & Whitney engines for the Air Force. A bit later, the university became the ground school contractor for a pilot training program, initially liaison pilots, at the Horlick-Racine Airport. I was made coordinator of the program, hiring qualified instructors for courses in navigation, meteorology, aircraft engine maintenance, and so on, and providing continual contact with Carlisle Gotsky, owner of the airport, who had had the ground school contract, the flight school contract, and hired the flight instructors. No other university personnel than myself was involved. I was under the general supervision of Chester Allen in the Extension Division, which had responsibility for these contracts. It was a hectic time for me. I would rise about 6 a.m., get to Nash by 7:18, the official start of my shift, work until 3:30, drive to the airport in Racine, work there until my evening classes, which ran from 7 to 10. Sometimes almost a whole week would pass without my seeing my son, who was then about 5. I was planning to leave the Extension Division as soon as the war ended, but in 1944, L.H. Adelson took over as dean of the division, and the entire spirit and direction of the organization changed. When the new Extension Center in Racine opened, in its own building in 1946, its future looked good. The first term saw an enrollment of about 300, and the numbers grew for several years as the returning veterans swelled the ranks. The classes immediately after the war were the most stimulating of my entire teaching career. The veterans were eager to make up for lost time, and they worked hard, forcing the younger, just out of high school youngsters to buckle down in order to compete. They asked good questions, and they demanded good answers. Some of them, of course, were not capable enough to survive. It was difficult to flunk a prospective engineer in an elementary math course, but kinder than to let him slide through to be knocked out later. We had a good faculty for freshman-sophomore work, and research in the 50s showed that students from the centers who finished their work in Madison had slightly higher grade point averages in Madison than those who took all 4 years on the main campus. With our own building, we now were able to add biology, chemistry, and physics to give a completely normal freshman-sophomore curriculum. I'm sure that the main reason that quality was maintained was the strong tie with the Madison campus through department chairman. Each department in the Extension Division had its own chairman, who also was on the faculty of the Madison Department. Sometimes this chairman was simultaneously chairman of the Madison Department. For example, Henry Hill of your own history department served in this double role in the 1950s. As assistant director of the Racine Center, I had primary responsibility for the growing adult evening program in credit and non-credit courses. This was not my cup of tea, so in the 1953-54 school year, I told the director, Wedemeyer, that I wanted to relinquish the assistant directorship and go back to full-time teaching. As it happens, Wedemeyer was transferred to Madison to become head of the large correspondence study program, and I agreed to stay on as director until they could find someone else. I found the job was much more interesting and challenging and stayed on for 15 years. During that time, I had a series of fine assistant directors who were trained in adult education matters. It worked out well. All the expenses of running the building in Racine, heat, light, janitorial staff, repairs, and so on, were borne by the city of Racine. I prepared and presented a budget each year. Starting in 1958, I began to suggest to the city council our growing need for a new building, and in the early 60s, we gained council approval. The board chairman of Western Publishing Company, William Wadowitz, bought up and gave to the city well-positioned lakefront property for the use of the university, and construction began in 1963. The new building was dedicated in the fall of 65 and was undoubtedly the finest facility of its kind in the state. In 1967, the University of Wisconsin Parkside was born to be housed between Racine and Kenosha. Racine leaders had tried hard to have the new facility on our expanded site of the Racine Center, but the university rightly decided that not enough room would be available. In its beginnings, all Parkside classes were taught at the Racine and Kenosha centers. As more and more facilities were built on the new Parkside campus, Racine first, and then Kenosha, were phased out. The Racine campus was taken over by the Racine Vocational School. Going back, in the Extension Center days, all faculty were appointed by the Extension Division Department Chairman. If we needed a history instructor, for example, Henry Hill would select a candidate, send him to me for an interview. I had a residual veto power if I felt the individual just wouldn't fit in, but in fact that was never exercised. Every fall, before classes began, the entire staff of all the centers would meet in Madison for a general get-together, followed by departmental meetings. This helped to set the tone for the ensuing year and to renew and establish personal contacts. In the late spring of each year, the Racine Center had a special convocation to honor students who had achieved especially well in some area of student activity, scholastic or extracurricular. We always had an important speaker from the Madison campus. I remember one vividly. Early in the school year, this was the early 60s, I had lined up Fred Harrington, then vice president under Elvium, for the following spring. Just a month or so before the convocation, Harrington accepted the presidency of the University of Alaska and was busy traveling back and forth to the still frozen north. I fully expected him to cancel out, especially since he was leaving Wisconsin, apparently forever. But he and his wife showed up. He did his usual fine job. They stayed on for the reception which followed the convocation. I was tremendously impressed by this completely unselfish act. Shortly thereafter, of course, Elvium died and Harrington was released by Alaska to become Wisconsin's president. In 1961, I was honored by the Johnson Foundation at a festive celebration at Wingspread to mark my 25th year with the university. Dean Mark Ingram, who had been my major professor, was the main speaker. Elvium, Harrington, Adolphson, and other university brass were present. It was a happy occasion for me. One other non-academic anecdote of the times. Wingspread was built by Frank Lloyd Wright, who was a close friend of H.F., that's Hibb, Johnson. It was the Johnson residence for many years before becoming the headquarters of the Johnson Foundation. As with many other Wright design buildings, leaks were not uncommon at Windspread. Sam Johnson, the present head of the company and son of HF, told me of an incident in his youth. There was a formal dinner party at Windspread. A rainstorm came up. Suddenly drops were falling on the master at the head of the table. He was furious. Had the butler bring a phone, called Wright, and in livid tone said, "Frank, I am sitting at table with a dinner party and rain is falling on my head. Do you have any suggestions?" Said Wright, "Move your chair, Hib, move your chair." About 1963, the centers were taken out of extension and became a separate entity under the name the University of Wisconsin Center System. Adelson gave up the extension division to become head of the center system. Center directors were given the title of dean. Somewhere in the 60s, I was made an honorary member of Phi Kappa Phi. At that time, and I suppose still today, five members of the University of Wisconsin staff were so honored each year. I'm also a member of Phi Beta Kappa and Sigma Xi from my undergraduate days. And now some assorted observations and anecdotes. Kenneth Wegener, who got his PhD in math in 1934-35, took a job at some Washington college as full professor and head of the department. After about 2 years, he resigned to become an instructor at the University of Minnesota. He wound up spending most of his academic career at Carleton. Paul Trump also got his degree about that time, and then later became Dean of Men on the Madison campus. The only other graduate student at that time whose whereabouts I recall is H.L., I think were the initials, Turretin, who had a long career as professor of mathematics at the University of Minnesota. As an instructor in Madison in the early 30s, I was impressed by a happening which would not have been the same at most Big Ten schools, I think. I had the captain of the football team in my calculus class. He seemed to be of average intelligence and ability, but I think was beset with personal problems that kept him from doing acceptable work in the course, and I had to flunk him. At no time was any pressure brought on me by the athletic department or alumni to let him through. Does the name Paul Weyrich ring a bell? You will find that he is presently head of one of the strong right-wing organizations in the United States. He began his academic career about 1960 in the Racine Center and showed his ultra-conservative leanings early on. During his sophomore year, a member of the University Board of Visitors asked to visit the Racine Center, part of a statewide visitation, and to meet with a representative small group of students. I felt that she should have a full gamut of student views, so I included Weyrich in the group. After the meeting, she came to my office to announce that Weyrich had accused his history instructor of being a communist and that she would have to report this back to the board. I called Henry Hill, then the history department chairman, and we agreed that if the board pressed charges in any way, we would back the instructor to the hilt. He was an arrogant, ill-mannered individual, to my mind, a poor teacher because he ridiculed any dissenting views in his classes, and I would not have objected had the department let him go at the end of the year because of poor teaching. But this was an entirely different matter, one of academic freedom. Fortunately, nothing more came of the matter. In the late 30s, the idea of bringing the university to the student reached a new peak. I traveled twice a week, to the small community of Williams Bay, home of Yerkes Observatory, to give a section of college algebra upstairs in the firehouse. I don't remember what other subjects were taught to these students or by whom. Finally, an academic story that may still be making the rounds. If not, it should be revived. A young freshman came to Madison, registered in 5 courses, attended the first day of class in each course, and then appeared no more. After a sufficient number of absences had been recorded, he was automatically dropped from each course. But when final exams rolled around, he appeared and took all 5 exams, getting over 90 in each one. This was such an unusual occurrence that it was finally brought to the attention of the president, who decided to call in the young man. So the freshman came to the president's office, sat on one side of a long table opposite the president and some deans, and the president himself took over. "Young man," he said, "you have posed quite a problem for us. Apparently you attended the first day of each class, then disappeared, and now have taken all your finals with an average grade of about 93. How do you explain this?" "Well, sir," said the little freshman, "I'm sorry about that, and I want to apologize. Those exams were really easy, and I should have done better, but that first day of class got me all balled up." Good luck, Mr. Jenkins. Over and out.